Hello, my name's Dave Emery. In the next 2 half-hour segments, we're going to be exploring some possible biological warfare connections to the Persian Gulf War Syndrome. Now, of course, Gulf War Syndrome is a term that has been applied to a number of ailments that appear to be afflicting veterans of the Persian Gulf War. It also, of course, has been very much a topic of heated debate between those veterans and their supporters and American officialdom, which to a large extent has either denied that the problem exists or has tended to downplay the nature of the problem. It is a matter of public record and was discussed in a two-part series entitled Kamel Hussein and the Iraqgate Scandal, that the United States and other Western countries had a great deal to do with the arming of Saddam Hussein. Many of the weapons that Saddam Hussein and Iraq eventually acquired were utilized by Saddam and Iraq in the Persian Gulf War. There are indications that some of this weaponry may have entailed biological warfare components, and there are some indications that some of these biological weapons may have affected our troops in the Persian Gulf War, either by being fired as munitions or perhaps as accidental contaminants following the destruction of some of the biological and chemical warfare bases. Official studies have indicated that in the United States have indicated that the Persian Gulf syndrome either doesn't exist or is psychosomatic, and the unwillingness or reluctance on the part of officialdom to recognize Gulf War syndrome has been a source of heated debate in the United States. One of those studies that downplayed the nature of Gulf War Syndrome or the extent of Gulf War Syndrome was a 1994 Pentagon study that dismissed links between chemical and biological weapons and the various illnesses that have afflicted Persian Gulf War veterans. It now appears that a renowned geneticist who was involved with this particular study also was very closely connected to a firm which may very well have shipped biological warfare weapons or components to Saddam Hussein. Reading now from the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, November 27th of 1996, this is a Newsday story by Patrick J. Sloyan, S-L-O-Y-A-N. I'm not sure about the pronunciation of this writer's name. This is a story that is datelined Washington and headlined, Gulf Syndrome Scientist Linked to Anthrax Firm. It reads in part as follows. A Nobel laureate who headed a 1994 Pentagon study that dismissed links between between chemical and biological weapons and Persian Gulf War illnesses was also a director of a U.S. company that had earlier exported anthrax and other lethal materials to Iraq before the 1991 conflict, according to federal records. Renowned geneticist Joshua Lederberg, L-E-D-E-R-B-E-R-G of New York, served as chairman of the Defense Science Board Task Force on Persian Gulf War Health Effects. At the time of the 1994 study, Lederberg was also one of 10 directors on the board of American Type Culture Collection, or ATCC. Newsday has found that the nonprofit Rockville, Maryland Company made 70 government-approved shipments of anthrax and other disease-causing pathogens to Iraqi, turning to an inside page, scientists between 1985 and 1989, according to congressional records. Lederberg became a director, an unpaid position, in 1990, a year after the shipments were halted by the Bush administration. Lederberg resigned from ATCC last year. During and after the 1991 Gulf War, U.S. intelligence became convinced that ATCC shipments, along with supplies from other countries, had been used by Iraqi President Saddam Hussein's scientists for an expanded biological weapons program, according to U.S. officials. A U.S. official who spoke on condition of anonymity said ATCC products, designed for research, were ideal for growing tiny samples into wartime stocks. Quote, they, ATCC, were not the only source, but they made a contribution, unquote, to the Iraqi weapons program, the official said. For the Bush administration, those Iraqi biological weapons were the, quote, nightmare scenario, unquote, of the 1991 Gulf War, a potential Scud rocket warhead filled with anthrax attacking Tel Aviv, prompting an Israeli nuclear counterattack on Baghdad. More than 150,000 frontline U.S. combat troops got anthrax vaccine injections, according to Desert Storm records. Despite the wartime fears, UN Special Commission investigators in Iraq have found no evidence that Baghdad used biological weapons or even succeeded in developing the pathogens into usable battlefield munitions. Well, there are, in fact, indications that some of these biological weapons were developed into useful battlefield munitions, and there are even some indications that some of those munitions may have been deployed. One of the types of pathogens that apparently was made into a successful munitions-capable device was apparently a toxin known as aflatoxin, derived from a fungus, which, when deployed in munitions warheads, can produce a liver cancer causing, well, basically will produce liver cancer over a period of time. Now, this is not a fast-acting weapon, but rather one that acts over a period of time, but there are indications that these munitions were developed. Please note also the potential conflict of interest role of Joshua Lederberg in sitting on being affiliated with that Pentagon study and in sitting on the board of ATCC, not an altogether disinterested party with regard to Gulf War syndrome. Research credit on the following article goes to a listener. This is from the Oakland Tribune of Thursday, October 17th of 1996. This is a London Observer Service article, Dateline London, and headlined, Saddam's arsenal had time bombs for liver cancer. The article reads, Saddam Hussein's arsenal of weapons of mass destruction included biological bombs that would have caused liver cancer in their victims many months after they were detonated, it has been revealed. And, the UN Security Council was told this week, there's no guarantee that, quote, cancer time bombs, unquote, have all been destroyed. UN officials overseeing the dismantlement of Iraq's non-conventional weaponry are mystified about the military purpose of the weapons, which are filled with aflatoxin. This is a toxin associated with fungal-contaminated food grains that had been considered non-lethal but were known to induce liver cancer. In August, the CIA published a report on Gulf War syndrome, the disorder suffered by Gulf War veterans who suspect chemical or biological weapons as the cause. It said that, quote, with the possible exception of aflatoxin, all declared Iraqi biological agents were intended to cause rapid death or incapacitation, unquote. I would interject, we're going to take a look at information indicating that this is not the case, but let's proceed with this account. The report noted, again quoting, the only documented effects of aflatoxin in humans are liver cancer months to years after it is ingested and symptoms, possibly including death, caused by liver damage from ingestion of large amounts, unquote. UNSCOM, the UN Special Commission Dismantling Saddam's Superweapons, assesses that Iraq looked at aflatoxin for its long-term carcinogenic effects and the testing showed that large concentrations of it caused death within days, unquote. A UNSCOM report to the United Nations in October of 1995 said Iraq began studies on aflatoxin in May of 1988 at its Al-Salman facility, where the toxin was produced by the growth of the fungus Aspergillus in 5.3-quart flasks. Now, please note not only aflatoxin but Aspergillus. We're going to come back to these in just a few minutes. In 1989, aflatoxin production was moved to a facility at Fudalia. Here, between the spring of 1990 and December of 1990, a total of about 481 gallons of toxin in solution was produced. Trials using aflatoxin warheads in 122-millimeter artillery rockets and R-400 aerial bombs were conducted in November of 1989, May of 1990, and August of 1990. Iraq's arsenal at the time of the Gulf War included 16 R-400 aflatoxin bombs and two aflatoxin warheads for enhanced Scud missiles. In total, said UNSCOM, Iraq produced 572 gallons of concentrated aflatoxin, of which 410.8 gallons were filled into munitions. There's no evidence that Iraq's aflatoxin weapons were used or that their contents were released into the air by mistake or as a result of bombing by the Gulf War allies. Well, I would point out that in an excerpt of an interview with Dr. Garth Nicholson, who along with his wife, Dr. Nancy Nicholson, has done some seminal research on Gulf War syndrome, we're going to be hearing, and this will take place in the next half-hour segment, that a great many of the Persian Gulf War veterans who have died of strange diseases have died of strange cancers. So again, I think there's more research to be done into the possibility of cancer toxins, and their either accidental or deliberate deployment against U.S. troops during the Persian Gulf War. As noted in the earlier San Francisco Chronicle article and in other broadcasts that I've done about the so-called Iraqgate scandal, namely the arming by the United States and other Western nations of Saddam Hussein, giving him his military capabilities and in particular his weapons of mass destruction capability. And again, there's a two-part series about that, dealing with Kamel Hussein, Saddam Hussein's brother-in-law, and his role in obtaining weaponry from the West. That is available from Spitfire, and I'll give the address, etc., at the end of this half-hour segment. One of the interesting things about the aflatoxin and the fact that it comes from aspergillus is that aflatoxin, aspergillus, and their effects in inducing liver cancer were the focal point of research that was being conducted by a number of institutions whose research may very well have been involved in the foundational research that ultimately led to the development of AIDS. This may appear to be utter madness to the uninitiated. Suffice it to say that for many years now I've done work about AIDS and the possibility that it stems from the application of genetic engineering to biological warfare. There's a remarkable recent book that I've dealt with in a number of broadcasts. It's entitled Emerging Viruses, subtitled AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident, or Intentional. The book was authored by Dr. Leonard G. Horowitz and is published in hardcover by Tetrahedron, copyrighted 1996. Tetrahedron is T-E-T-R-A-H-E-D-R-O-N, one word. And a little more about how to obtain this book. First of all, there's an 800 number that people can call in order to obtain the book. That's 800-336-9266. That's 800-336-9266. You can also reach Tetrahedron at Post Office Box 402, Rockport, Massachusetts, 01966. Once again, that's Post Office Box 402, Rockport, Massachusetts, 01966. And the 800 number again, 800-336-9266. We've not got time to even begin to do justice to Dr. Leonard Horowitz's remarkable book, Emerging Viruses. I've dealt with this in other broadcasts, and we'll be dealing with it again in the future. Suffice it to say that Dr. Horowitz has developed some very compelling information that a number of civilian, or at least ostensibly civilian, institutions may very well have contributed to the research that ultimately led to the development of AIDS. Again, we have not got time due to the limitations of tape here and the broadcast format to even begin to do justice to the research that Dr. Horowitz has done. Suffice it to say that among the institutions who figure in the background of the research that may very well have led to the deliberate development of AIDS, concerns not only the National Cancer Institute, and in particular its Molecular Oncology Laboratory at Frederick, Maryland, which essentially comprises Fort Detrick, the Army's top chemical and biological warfare research center, for the most part turned over to ostensibly civilian purposes in the early 1970s for the, quote, war on cancer, unquote. Another of the institutions that looms large in the foundational research that may very well have led to the development of AIDS is an organization called the IARC, or the International Association for Research into Cancer. The NCI, the IARC, and also Litton Bionetics, and Merck Incorporated, that's M-E-R-C-K, all institutions with very strong connections to biological warfare research, were deeply involved in a number of lines of research in the late 60s and early 1970s, including research into hepatitis B and various esophageal cancers in Africa. They also were doing research into liver cancer. Among the interesting aspects of this research is that the cancer research and hepatitis B research that was going on focused almost exclusively on black Africa, whereas these are diseases that are found all over the world. Again, we haven't got time to do justice to this research due to the limitations of time. Suffice it to say, however, that aflatoxin, again, the liver cancer-inducing toxin that Saddam Hussein appears to have had some of, and the aspergillus fungus from which it is derived, were two of the major focal points of some of the research and of the research institutions that may very well have been involved with the foundational research that led to the development of AIDS. Turning now to emerging viruses, by Dr. Leonard Horowitz, we read of the NCI and the aforementioned IARC, again the International Association for Research into Cancer. The NCI reported that IARC was established in 1965 under the auspices of the World Health Organization. Initially sponsored by the five most active NATO countries, the Federal Republic of Germany, France, Italy, the United Kingdom, and the United States, and based in Lyon, France, IARC began work with a budget of $750,000 per year. The budget for 1973 was $3.5 million, as 10 other countries joined the organization, including the Soviet Union. Indeed, when attention began to focus on the apparent link between virus infections and cancers, IARC focused its research efforts principally on Africa. The reasons for this are also suspicious. Despite the existence of cancers in most parts of the world, IARC targeted esophageal cancer and liver cancer, both in black African populations. And skipping down, bear in mind again the liver cancer, the aflatoxin and aspergillus connections to the Saddam Hussein liver cancer biological warfare capability. Skipping down, we read in from emerging viruses, liver cancer was second on the list of IARC priorities. To determine the relationship between aflatoxin, a toxic chemical produced by the fungus Aspergillus flavus, and liver cancer, IARC studied individuals in Kenya and elsewhere in Africa. The problem, and in quoting from the study, the problem has been further compounded by recent work on hepatitis virus and liver cancer. Serologic studies show that hepatitis B antigen, or HBAG, is associated with up to 50% of liver cancers in Africa and Asia, and then in parenthesis, Dr. Horowitz puts, two areas of the world wherein AIDS prevalence rates are highest, being found in about 6% of controls. Much lower frequencies were obtained in North America and in Europe. While much remains to be discovered about hepatitis B antigen, there now exist two putative etiologic agents, one chemical and the other viral. Intensive study is needed to show whether they are both in fact responsible for liver cancer, and if so, whether they operate independently or together. A survey of 5,000 individuals has been carried out over 2 years in West Africa to determine the natural history of hepatitis B antigen. And the passage continues, Len Horowitz adds, besides IARC's interest in hepatitis B, and he goes on to add, even more important perhaps are the seroepidemiologic studies being carried out with the support of the U.S. National Cancer Institute, Bethesda, Maryland, and the East African Virus Research Institute in Tebe, Uganda. The agency has been studying nasopharyngeal carcinoma in Asia and Burkitt's lymphoma in Africa, neoplasms associated serologically with a herpes virus, a C-type RNA virus. As Len Horowitz goes to point out in elsewhere in his book and throughout his book, the research that I've been touching on and other related programs appears to have led to the development of AIDS. And Len Horowitz makes an excellent case that AIDS first appeared in the American population as a result of the Merck Incorporated developed experimental hepatitis B vaccine. The point being here that the aflatoxin aspergillus fungus liver cancer connection was one of the elements that turned up in the foundational research that, according to Dr. Horowitz and others, may very well have led to the development of AIDS, and it certainly appears to have figured in the background, or not in the background, but in the foreground of Saddam Hussein's biological warfare component as well. Whether or not some of those liver bombs or some of those cancer bombs have led to some of the strange cancers that Gulf War veterans have been dying of remains to be determined. One of the seminal pieces of work into a possible biological warfare connection to Persian Gulf War syndrome has been done by the aforementioned Dr. Garth Nicholson and his wife, Dr. Nancy Nicholson. There are indications now that some elements within Washington may be beginning to take a look at their work and to assess it with a degree of objectivity. Reading now from the San Jose Mercury News of Friday, December 27th of 1996, the following is an AP story datelined Breakthrough on Gulf War Syndrome, subtitled, The Army Agrees to Probe a State Biochemist's Claim of a Successful Treatment. Again, this is an AP story datelined Washington. Army scientists have agreed to investigate a California researcher's claim that he has found a possible bacterial explanation for some illnesses suffered by Persian Gulf War veterans. Army Major General Leslie Berger, B-U-R-G-E-R, commander of Walter Reed Army Medical Center, will bring together federal and independent scientists next month to determine how to probe biochemist Garth Nicholson's research into mycoplasma, M-Y-C-O-P-L-A-S-M-A, which are microorganisms known to cause disease sometimes. Nicholson says he found a genetically altered version of mycoplasma in the blood of half of the several hundred sick veterans he has tested. He says antibiotics have successfully treated some of them. At a meeting Monday, infectious disease experts agreed that investigating Nicholson's work, quote, is not an unreasonable approach, unquote, Walter Reed spokesman Ben Smith said Thursday. But Pentagon spokeswoman Donna Boltz, B-O-L-T-Z, cautioned that the government has not agreed to act to fund actual medical research into mycoplasma and veterans, skipping down. Nicholson, director of the nonprofit Institute for Molecular Medicine in Irvine, California, contends the mycoplasma was genetically altered deliberately as a biological weapon. The Pentagon had refused to collaborate with Nicholson, prompting Representative Norm Dix, Democrat of Washington, to arrange Monday's meeting. Quote, we owe it to the people who are still ill to look at this more thoroughly, unquote, Dix said. What we're going to do now is to begin listening to an interview with Dr. Garth Nicholson. This was conducted on October 20th, 1996, and was part of a radio broadcast symposium about genetic engineering and biological warfare. The other participants in this broadcast were Dr. Alan Cantwell, the author of AIDS and the Doctors of Death, among other titles, the aforementioned Dr. Leonard Horowitz, the author of Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident, or Intentional, Ed Haslam, the author of Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus, softcover Wordsworth Press, copyright 1995, and, of course, Dr. Garth Nicholson. We're now going to join this interview in progress. And it's my pleasure to introduce a fourth guest this evening. This is Dr. Garth Nicholson, who, along with his wife, Dr. Nancy Nicholson, has done some very important and fascinating research concerning a possible biological warfare component to the Persian Gulf War syndrome. Dr. Nicholson, welcome to our program.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on.
Dr. Nicholson, along with your wife, Dr. Nancy Nicholson, you have been doing research into some of the causes of Persian Gulf War syndrome, something that's very much in the news these days. And in some of the papers you've written, you've attributed that syndrome to a number of different causes, including a organism called a mycoplasma. Could you tell us a little bit about what a mycoplasma is and what makes this particular mycoplasma special and how you came across it?
Well, it's a very simple microorganism, very similar to a bacteria. It's not very complex in terms of the biologic systems that we normally deal with, but it's more complex than a virus. So it has genetic information in it, and what we've found is that in about one half of the Gulf War illness patients that we've looked at, there's a very unusual type of microorganism, a mycoplasma, found deep inside their white blood cells. And this unusual form of mycoplasma has an inserted gene in it from the HIV-1 virus, the AIDS-causing virus. And it's very interesting because the gene that we found in it is exactly the type of gene that you'd put in this if you wanted to make a biologic weapon. Because this is the gene that encodes an envelope glycoprotein called GP120, and this is the component that's a receptor that allows this microorganism, we think, to attach to cells and enter cells, just like the AIDS virus enters your cells.
Now, Dr. Horowitz has written about the mechanism by which the virus enters the cells as well. Could you tell us a little bit about how this, explain for the layperson how the HIV or this apparently genetically engineered mycoplasma enters the cells?
Well, we think it uses a variety of receptors, mainly a receptor complex called the CD4 receptor complex. And it attaches to this and then is taken in what's known as an endocytotic vesicle inside the cell. And then it gets loose from that, and then the genetic information gets into the cell and goes into the nucleus, eventually. And that's basically how it enters. It's much more complex than that, but I think for your listening audience, that will suffice.
So in other words, this mechanism, which is on this mycoplasma, actually enables the organism to enter into an a cell's wall.
Well, that's what we think. We think it allows it to penetrate inside the cell, and that's what makes this particular microorganism so insidious, because once it's in the cell, it can use its metabolism more or less to poison the cell, and this causes a tremendous amount of problems. And also, when it divides inside the cell and is released eventually from the cell, it can take a little piece of membrane with it, and this sets up kind of an immune response against cells. So it actually can trigger an autoimmune response, and we often see in these Gulf War illness patients very unusual autoimmune symptoms, very similar to MS, ALS, Graves' disease, for example, lupus, but they don't have these rare genetic diseases. In fact, we see some symptoms, combination of different diseases in the same patient. And all of these seem to go away when we treat with the appropriate antibiotics. So we don't think that these soldiers really had these unusual genetic diseases. We think that the mycoplasma may have caused these signs and symptoms which mimic these genetic diseases.
And in an historical element, how did you first come across this organism?
Well, we got involved in this because our stepdaughter was served in Operation Desert Storm. She was a crew chief on a Black Hawk helicopter involved in the deep insertions into Iraq. And when she came back, she slowly came down with a chronic illness that we couldn't explain. It was very unusual, and there were so many different signs and symptoms. There were 30 or 40 different signs and symptoms, and then we slowly started to get it, and we noticed when we called around to several of her colleagues and so on that not only did they have the disease, but also their family members were starting to come down with it. So we knew that we weren't dealing with a chemical weapon. We were probably dealing with a biologic weapon that she picked up in Operation Desert Storm. Now, we traced this down just by going through these complex signs and symptoms, going back through the medical literature, trying to figure out what it might be. We ruled out a lot of different diseases which are more acute in nature, tried to settle on some of the chronic illnesses and what they might be caused by, and then we finally settled on mycoplasmas as a possibility, and sure enough, when we did the genetic testing, that's exactly what we found.
In your opinion, how did these troops become infected with this, or are you in a position to say?
Well, we've actually, in our testimony to the U.S. Congress, we've stated that there are four possible ways in which they were exposed. The first is that some of them may have gotten contaminated vaccines. And mycoplasmal contamination of vaccines is not uncommon because often they're made in animals, and animals are just as susceptible to humans in picking up these mycoplasmal infections. The second is that there were certain areas in the desert, which we call exclusionary zones, in which the Iraqis may have actually placed chemical and biologic weapons, both by spraying them and by releasing them. And the military intelligence units that were deep in Iraq ran across some of these areas. They found that everything human and animal was dead in these areas. And so that's the second way. And the third is a more popular notion now, although when we presented it, it really did not receive any press at all. And that's the blowback from destroyed bunkers and factories which contain chemical and biologic weapons. And as you know, the press has picked up on this recently, and now they've indicated that it's very likely that at least 15,000 soldiers were exposed to nerve agents and other chemical agents when they blew up these bunkers. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. In fact, they blew up hundreds of these bunkers and also a variety of different factories as well that had the biologic agents and chemical agents. And these could have been blown back across our lines because the prevailing winds during the time of the conflict were from northeast to southwest. So this would have carried all these agents back across our lines. And they would have been diluted, so they're probably in low level, and that would have explained why there weren't a large number of immediate signs and symptoms on the battlefield. It took some time after they returned home. And then finally, the Scud missiles that rained down on Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, Western Kuwait, for example, these often were manned, or they were tipped with skyburst warheads. So instead of using a high-explosive warhead, some of the warheads were low-yield warheads that blew up at 2,000 to 5,000 feet in the air, and they had dispersing capabilities, so they dispersed kind of a mist all over the battlefield, and this was described by a number of units, particularly reserve units behind the lines. And those units that were under Scud attack, they have very high casualties now. So there's not a uniform degree of casualties among the various units. It was very deployment dependent. And some of the units that were hardest hit were way behind the lines that were under Scud attack. So we think that may have played a very important role as well.
That concludes this half-hour segment. We've been listening to a portion of an interview with Dr. Garth Nicholson, recorded as part of a radio symposium on October 20th, 1996. This interview will be continued in our next segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.